So good afternoon, everyone, members. I'm happy to have everybody here. The Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Burton.
Here.
Representatives Altman.
Here.
Bertana.
Here.
Brown. Buchanan.
Here.
Davis.
Here.
Duran.
Here.
Garrison.
Here.
Grant.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Masullo.
Here.
Mello.
Here.
Persons Mulica.
Here.
Rayner is excused. Rizzo. F. Robinson.
Here.
W. Robinson.
Here.
Mr. Roy.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Tant.
Here.
Yarborough.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Cheryl. Members and everybody with us today, just a friendly reminder, we do every time. Please make sure you silence whatever electronic device you communicate with on a regular basis. Members, I am sure you have had conversations, as have I, both during the summertime, before we were in committee weeks, and certainly since committee weeks have begun, about staffing issues across healthcare provider spectrum, from hospitals to long-term care facilities to physicians' offices. It runs the gamut. So we thought it would be worthwhile to invite some panelists to be with us today to give us their perspective and to begin an in-depth conversation about the crisis that they see and the reality of the healthcare staffing issue here in the state of Florida. So we really are grateful that the four of you have joined us today. Thank you for that. We've also anticipated there might be a few audience members or other individuals who want to address us. Right now, we only have one card, but we'll leave a little bit of time at the end, because once the agenda went out on this meeting, as you all can imagine, everybody and anybody, which was a lot, who was concerned about this issue wanted to be part of the conversation. That, I think, is an indication to us how widespread the issue is here in the state of Florida. So with us today, we have Stephen Bennett. Mr. Bennett is Workforce Development Manager for the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. Welcome. Mary Mayhew, President and CEO of the Florida Hospital Association. Welcome back. Aurelio Fernandez, CEO of Memorial Health System. Glad you're with us. And Tracy Green, the Vice President of Operations of Southern Healthcare Management. Thank you for being here today as well, Tracy. So we will start with Mr. Bennett. We're going to recognize you for your presentation. So if you would please join us at the podium, you are recognized.
Madam Chair, thank you for having me. I'm Stephen Bennett from the Florida Association of Community Health Centers, the Workforce Development Manager, representing my CEO, Andy Bierman, to talk about some of the current challenges our community health centers are facing throughout the state. Some stuff that perhaps you may have heard, some information or data that perhaps might be new. We'll work through this relatively quickly. So quickly about us, we are the designated primary care association for the 52 community health centers throughout the state. We do a variety of activities around training and technical assistance. Kind of runs the gamut in terms of whatever the health centers need, we try and be a resource for them. We pride ourselves on really sort of one purpose, that we want to support the community health centers as the primary care safety net throughout the state. So helping citizens from all backgrounds, regardless of their station in life, regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of insurance, make sure that they have access to quality health care. I want to focus on really three sort of key areas that we try and help, three different components. So number one, we go into our health centers throughout the state to pinpoint, to diagnose the various pain points that they have around their workforce efforts. So I always say one of two things, either what's keeping you up at night or what's causing you heartburn. What are those pieces that are keeping you from getting to your workforce goals? We want to pinpoint and diagnose. We then want to use evidence-based solutions, evidence-based strategies that are going to help mitigate those barriers. And then always with a focus on creating that more diverse and equitable and inclusive work environment and workforce, not just because that's a good goal in and of itself, but we know that it has direct impact on patient outcomes. And making sure that we have a representative workforce. Very quickly about our health centers, we have 52 either federally qualified health centers or what we call lookalikes throughout the state, with a geographic footprint throughout the entire state, more than 700 locations. So you can't go anywhere in Florida without having access to one of the health centers. Last year, nearly 1.6 million Floridians were part of the patient base for our health centers, with more than 6 million visits. Of note, 71% of those patients are at the federal poverty line or below, and a full 90% are at the 200% poverty line. So when we talk about access for all, not just theory, it's in practice with our health centers, and we're proud of that. More than 13,000 jobs at these 52 health centers, with an economic impact of more than 21,000 jobs and $2.6 billion within our economy. So understanding the challenge. First and foremost, right now, for a variety of reasons, this isn't news, this is a seller's market when we think about it from an economics perspective. Job seekers have lots of choices right now for where they want to work, and therefore they have a lot of control. We'll get into to some of that. Competition within healthcare is significant right now. There is a lot of churn within healthcare organizations, individuals leaving one organization for another, private, for profit, whatever it might be. And we're trying to sort of get our hands around that, but that churn is significant right now. Retention of that qualified workforce. We hear lots of comments from our practitioners, from our leaders throughout the health centers, that they've never seen it as challenging as it is right now. And COVID-19 obviously has had an impact. I will say there aren't a lot of the issues we're going to talk about today that COVID-19 has necessarily created, but it's certainly the pandemic has illuminated those challenges, has made them more apparent. So if we look at recruitment and retention, within our health centers. So just quite frankly, they're struggling to recruit new talent. To be very honest, we are private nonprofit entities, cannot compete on the for-profit side in terms of wages. It's a long-term battle. We're experiencing and feeling that right now. Non-healthcare industries are not only recruiting, but really poaching workers. So we are seeing individuals leaving for jobs in fast food, for jobs in the service industry, where they are paying, I saw something yesterday, McDonald's is paying as high as $21 an hour. That is going to impact entry-level individuals that are at $16, $17, $18 an hour, right? Now, long-term, can McDonald's continue to pay $21 an hour? No, so it's a short-term challenge that we're facing, but nevertheless, it's there. Credential and regulatory components continue to increase. What am I talking about? The cost of training. If we're looking at a medical assistant, a dental assistant, you can see gaps of costs for training ranging from $7,000 for a program, $20,000 for a program. And we're talking about wages that are $15 to $17, maybe $18 an hour to start. That's a pretty hefty price. Retention, incredibly difficult as well. So not only on the recruitment side, but we're seeing retention being impacted, both ends of the spectrum. Many of our CHCs, our community health centers, are reporting annual turnover approaching 30%. So the churn that I talked about is in all levels of the organization, entry-level, mid-level, to our providers. And it's significant, right? If you're talking about up to 30% of your workforce, that is constant movement, and you're losing those legacy resources of individuals and constantly bringing in new people. Advancement opportunities are limited, partly because of limited access to workforce resources, which we'll talk about in a second. But again, trying to figure out how we not only recruit, but then retain through advancement strategies remains a challenge. At some of our centers, up to 10% of their workforce is unfilled. So if we're talking about an organization with 400 people, you're looking at 40 positions that are unfilled. That's gonna have direct impact on patients. Not only makes the day harder for the individuals, but we're beginning to talk about how that's impacting patients, right? Not only just from scheduling out further, but the day-to-day operations and functions. Some key occupations that we are really worried about right now. So at the entry level, medical assistants and dental assistants, again, it's a wage issue for many. But we also know that it's an information issue, right? People don't necessarily understand that this can be a gateway position into a long-term career. At the mid-level, LPNs and RNs, LCSWs, all the way up to providers, right? So it's the whole spectrum of the workforce that we're struggling. Grow your own strategies. We're going to talk about that as a strategy, but it's a challenge as is right now. Our access to residency programs and our ability to recruit and retain providers via residency care programs isn't where it should be, isn't where we want it to be. That's a gap in the workforce solution. We need to move on that as an organization of health centers. Workforce dollars for our health centers are sometimes limited. State workforce dollars for incumbent training, which directly ties into advancement opportunities. Our 52 health centers aren't eligible for those because they happen to be nonprofit, non-hospital locations. So looking at how we leverage workforce dollars remains a challenge and is something that we're trying to figure out as well. Apprenticeship programs, what's near and dear to my heart. Apprenticeships work wonderfully in healthcare. They are very promising, but it really does require what we call a paradigm shift in thinking about how we do workforce throughout the centers. Briefly on COVID-19, what we would say is the issue is, of course, burnout that our health centers and the 13,000 employees are facing. We struggle to measure what that burnout looks like. That's a broader challenge that is not just within healthcare, but that has also ignited some challenges around the wage wars, right? So we have individuals leaving to go and be a traveling nurse, right, where they're going to make significantly more money doing that, but that's a temporary position, or they may go off after a six-month contract with no benefits, but again, that's a temporary position. As things begin to return to normal, what do they do? Do they return to us? But that wage war component is significant. All of this has led to a lack of certainty. So if we are looking at both short and long-term planning from a workforce perspective, it makes it very difficult. So not here just to complain, right? So our challenges, but we are doing some really what I call world-class different strategies within workforce development to try and sort of meet these challenges head on. And we'll go through those. So we've always supported that grow your own strategy, right? So figuring out how we as individual employers and as a community build that pipeline of talent. From the provider perspective, last year, we are very proud of this number. Nearly 2,500 individuals were placed within our community health centers in things like residency programs, whether it's pre-grad or post-grad programs. You can see the sort of variety of different disciplines. So whether it's medical or dental or behavioral health, vision, things like pharmacy, things like chiropractic. So a variety of providers being trained, having rotations, residency programs throughout the 52 centers is something we're very, very proud of. We want to grow that, though, that grow your own approach. So we are actively working on the development of apprenticeships. We have community health centers that have already launched a medical assistant apprenticeship where they are looking at incumbent existing staff in positions like phone centers, call centers, and transitioning them into apprentices for medical assistants. We are building one right now with dental assisting. We are going to go into the community, find our recruits for that program, start them with no training, give them a living wage, and do a 15-month apprenticeship program that will get them to a pretty significant wage by the end of those 15 months. We can't have those be anecdotes, though. We want that to be an overall strategy. We want that to be a systemic approach through that grow your own component. The academic health center that we have, we want to grow that footprint. right? Again, it's about growing your own, not just at the entry level, but throughout the whole spectrum of the workforce, all towards the end of developing what we call predictive pipeline development. So looking at how we partner with community-based organizations, with educational institutions, to be able to predict more accurately the pipeline. One opportunity that's in front of us this morning, that we just got an email this morning, is the federal government is putting forward a whole bunch of money for states to partner with them without a match that's required, no match required, to help with loan repayment for providers in primary care. So we would encourage that kind of collaboration because we can build a real significant pipeline with those kind of approaches. If we can look at loan repayment as an incentive, that helps our centers immensely. We are engaged in workforce planning, so we are really diving deep with these health centers to figure out, like we talked about, what are your pain points, what's keeping you up at night, looking at all kinds of different approaches. But our planning is really only as good as our actions that follow, right? So we're looking at things around recruitment and retention. We're specifically focusing on the churn that occurs within the first year of employment. So the 0 to 12 months of employment, where we see a lot of movement, and not the good kind. So we're looking at the strategies aligned with how do we go in, really from an intervention perspective, and help individuals help themselves build their career. So that 0 to 12 months is key. We're looking at strategies around what's it mean to be a millennial in the workforce. I'm on the upper end of the millennial group, so I'm not quite offended by it, but there is a different approach to work, and I think that's fair to acknowledge it. So what does it mean to be a millennial, and how are you being supported in the workforce? Trying to use data more intentionally, if you will, to understand what the pipeline looks like coming forward, and then defining priority occupations. So we know that medical assistants are growing, so 32% is the projected growth using federal data over the next, 7 years from this point. We need to be ready to onboard those people and help them build those careers. Career pathways, one of my favorite pieces that we're building. This is all about helping individuals be better at their job. So looking at it from a career perspective, how do you build a long-term approach in healthcare? But it's not just about you do this training and then you do this job and then hopefully you get a raise and then hopefully you get this next job. We're really looking at it from a holistic perspective. What are the barriers that prevent people from building their career? And how can, as an employer and as community partners, we come in and help mitigate those barriers? So if you look at job one and transportation is an issue, what kind of community partner can we look at to partner with for bus passes? If we know that childcare is an issue, how do we begin to address that? So that we can look at job two and then job three, and we've got a plan, person by person, organization by organization, understanding how they're going to mitigate those barriers to build their career. It's really a holistic approach. To what end are we doing this? The things that keep us up at night, the things that we're working toward. And I'll end with this. So as I started, we are the primary care safety net. We think that must remain true. We are proud to play that role, but we have to do the work right now around our workforce to make sure that that stays true. Building a world-class workforce requires world-class strategies. We think representation matters in healthcare. So we want to make sure we have the right workforce from all aspects, serving our patients with high quality. And we want to make sure that we're continuing to increase our ROI, the investment of tax dollars into our health centers that support the most needy, the investment of resources. We want to make sure that our ROI continues to grow and that we continue to be an anchor within the communities that we serve. This is for patients. This is for the workforce alike. That's my contact info. Look forward to answering any questions you may have later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. And members, just so that you all know, what I'd ask you to do is, as our speakers, our panelists address us, you'll just write down questions you have for the individual members of the panel. Then when we're finished, we will take questions to everybody at one time. That way I make sure none of our panelists feel rushed while they're giving their presentations. So thank you for that. Ms. Mayhew, you are next. Thank you for being here, and you're recognized.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Do I need to do anything to bring up our presentation? But I'll dive
in. Help is on the way.
Help's on the way, but I can dive in. Thank you. That was a fantastic presentation and really saves me from repeating and echoing a lot of that, because you will hear so many, as you said, similarities across the healthcare sector. I'm here, of course, representing, thank you, no worries. I'm here representing the Florida Hospital Association. Statewide, our hospitals employ over 300,000 employees. You know, I've said this repeatedly, under the best of circumstances, it is an incredibly demanding job to be in a 24/7 hospital environment. I'm going to focus significantly on our nurses, but the challenges we face in healthcare, of course, span across all of our various healthcare professions. Aurelio Fernandez from Memorial Health System is going to speak to some of the boots on the ground reality of what his system has faced, certainly acutely in their response to the pandemic. I'm going to share some data. We've spent the last 9 months looking at both in the short term what we've experienced for turnover rates, and then we worked collaboratively with the Safety Net Alliance on a study to forecast out several years at what we face as a shortage, particularly among our nurses. So in the spring, so this precedes the Delta surge, and prior to the pandemic, we were facing a workforce shortage, and of course, over decades, hospitals have had cyclical challenges with the healthcare workforce, with nursing shortages. There is something dramatically different about what we are facing. We certainly were starting to see challenges prior to the pandemic. The pandemic has obviously exacerbated. We have hospital leaders talking about the post-traumatic stress that their staff are facing, the trauma that they've experienced. In the spring, we collected data on both vacancy and turnover. What you're seeing here is Florida's current RN vacancy rate, 11%, slightly higher than the national vacancy rate. This is not unusually high compared to what we have seen in years past. But this is where we are seeing in our turnover rates a substantially higher rate of turnover. So among our nurses, 1 in 4 have left their positions, a 25% turnover rate among our nurses, 30% among our critical care nurses, nurses working in, of course, the intensive care unit. Again, given everything that they've experienced, and you can see over the years that we've been collecting this data, never have we seen a turnover rate that high. And then as you drill down, and you'll hear it, different hospitals have seen higher levels, some slightly lower, but all hospitals will attest to the fact that they have seen and experienced an unprecedented turnover rate in the last year. And again, to just emphasize what was shared before, we're all feeling the pressure from a variety of angles in terms of the exodus. Obviously, there are nurses who have left to pursue the opportunities with the contracted staffing agencies for a significantly higher pay, either in-state or out-of-state. Others, because of the stress and strain that they have been under, they have taken a break from healthcare. Others have retired early. All of this combining to create an incredible challenge. And as you know, healthcare is not unique. Across all economic sectors, employers are struggling to find employees. But in a 24/7 healthcare environment, we can't reduce the days or the hours. And what we saw during the Delta surge, we can bring beds in, but you still have to have the nurses, the physicians, the respiratory therapist to staff those beds. I mentioned the comprehensive analysis that we commissioned. along with the Safety Net Alliance, to look at, as we forecast out our pipeline, there's this urgency today, the demand for new nurses in the next 12, 24 months, and then how do we look as we start to look out 10 years if we don't change anything right now because of the situation? That report estimates that we will have a shortage of nearly 60,000 nurses by the year 2035, if we, given the population growth in Florida, the commensurate increase in demand for healthcare services. So we know we need to act now. We know we have urgent situations because of everything that we've experienced in responding to this pandemic now for nearly 20 months. But as our population continues to grow, our aging population, the demand will only intensify. So much for us to be looking at, and there were a lot of great comments about the multifaceted approach, and I know that Aurelio is going to dive into this a little bit more, but we understand that retention is a significant part of the equation, evaluating the environment. It is tough to make that demanding environment less demanding, but there are so many strategies around apprenticeships, mentors. Our hospitals are bringing in mental health resources, clergy, to help support that workplace environment. But I really would like the opportunity now to bring Aurelio up, if that's the next in the order, Madam Chair, or however you'd like to proceed, Madam Chair. But I will certainly conclude my remarks at this point.
As a matter of fact, you are correct. And Mr. Fernandez, I'd like to welcome you to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity. What I'd like to do today is put some reality into what's going on in healthcare. Memorial Healthcare System is a safety net healthcare system down in South Florida in Broward County. Six hospitals, 14,000 employees. It's referred to as a quaternary facility, which means that we do a lot of the work that other hospitals cannot do, i.e. heart transplants for pediatrics and adults. We do kidney transplants for both pediatrics and adults. Bone marrow transplant, so we're a quaternary facility. We do just about everything that has to be done. What this pandemic has done over the last 20 months is nothing that I've ever seen in my 45 years in healthcare. The stress level that Mr. Bennett referred to and the challenges that we have are unprecedented. And we're now facing what I consider a crisis in having adequate staffing to care for ourselves, our family members, and our seniors. The pandemic, and if you just visualize yourself, you're a nurse sitting in an ICU in a 12-hour shift, dressed up in protective gear, caring for patients, that if you're in an ICU with COVID and you are on a ventilator, 70% of those patients are not gonna go home. They're gonna go out in a buddy bag. That is extremely stressful. So the stress level that we as healthcare providers are facing has also added to folks wanting to do travel nursing because the pay could be three times as much. Folks not wanting to work in a hospital environment. Now, Memorial Healthcare System for the last 12 years has been by Modern Healthcare. Modern Healthcare is like the Wall Street Journal for business people, as best places to work in the United States. We received the recognition for the first time being the family-friendliest healthcare system in the United States. Most recently, we were recognized as one of the most trusted healthcare systems in the United States. And I can go on and on with all the accolades. And we still cannot get people through the door to work. It's a very challenging situation when you're having the nursing staff, the intensivists, the respiratory therapists working these number of shifts. And there's not enough out there. So what has happened, you've heard the name travelers. And travelers end up paying three times what a normal nurse will make. So there has been an outflow of qualified personnel leaving the area. And the schools are not able to backfill. I can tell you right now that we've met with the universities down and the colleges down in Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. And they're not out there. And the reason is faculty, believe it or not. There's a lot of interest in becoming a nurse or becoming a healthcare provider. We do not have enough faculties to be able to graduate the amount of healthcare providers that are necessary to meet the demands of the future. Now, what happened in August and September? 49% of our patients were COVID patients. 49%. I'll tell you the exact number, 744. I'll never forget that number. We paid in salaries for travelers, for combat pay, for shift differential, and overtime, $20 million in 1 month. In September, we paid another $20 million. Those numbers are unsustainable to the healthcare industry because our reimbursement is not increasing proportionally. So you're going to find margins being compressed. And without margins, you cannot grow the business. So this is a monumental task for the not only the hospital industry, but what Mr. Bennett said here as well, all healthcare providers. Now, I understand that the state of Florida doesn't have the right, the higher passing grade for nurses. So the NFLEX is called. They're not, we're like 2 percentage points below the national average. We recommend as a healthcare system that we partner with colleges and educators to expand the faculty base. But we have to do something with regards to pay. A nurse in a hospital makes significantly higher than what we do in a university setting. I realize that it's totally different, different services, but nevertheless, if we do not graduate more nurses, more respiratory therapists, more clinicians, we're going to be faced with a challenge unforeseen in the history of healthcare. At least in my lifetime, I've never seen anything like this. The opportunities to partner healthcare providers and university is there. They want us to be partners with them. As a matter of fact, we provide scholarships with Broward College for nurses who come work for us. We created 3 years ago a nursing residency program. In other words, when you graduate from nursing school, you go into our residency program, which lasts a year, and we feel that that year of residency makes that individual a better nurse. We also started just this year a fellowship program, similar to what Mr. Bennett was saying. You have to grow your own. So you usually get out of a nursing program, but now I want to become an ICU nurse, or now I want to become an emergency room nurse, or now I want to become a surgical nurse. So we provide another track for a year that will get the skill set of that potential clinician up to a level of performance that it creates a safe environment. The program has been very successful. We've enrolled over 1,000 nurses in the residency program since we started it 3 years ago. The retention rate is significantly higher than if you had a program that didn't have a residency program. As a matter of fact, it's like 91-92% of everyone who goes through the program is still with us after 2 years. What we're facing now is also what you saw up there, the turnover rate. We used to run 13% turnover. Today, we're attracted to about 22%. That includes everybody, not just nurses, everybody. We have 825 open positions last year. This year, we have 2,200. We have 650 nursing opening positions that are vacant. We cannot fill. So we fill it up with these travelers. Today, we have 490-some-odd nursing travelers that we're paying 3 times the average salary rate. I'm sharing all this because it is a problem, and it has to be addressed. And it cannot be addressed if we don't align ourselves with the education, with the universities, who are the ones that are providing the expertise and the knowledge to have clinicians care for us, because we're going to be patients in these hospitals or in these clinics. And we need that skill set that gives us the comfort that it's a safe environment. So I just want to relay the severity of the problem. I walked the ICUs last week in one of our hospitals, and these people are worn out. They're tired. Again, I go back to the statement, 12-hour shift, dressed up, in gear, caring for patients. And if you're in an ICU and you're in a ventilator, 70% of them will die in front of you. Now, you think about the stress level and the resilience of that staff and what are the resources that we as providers need to provide these professionals. We call them heroes. I'm sure you've seen the hero signs because they are heroes. And we're very proud of our workforce. But as human beings, we can only take so much stress. So I beg that this committee works out something with regard to bridging the educational component and the healthcare providers in the market, because otherwise you're looking at a 3-4 year run before we can see light at the end of the tunnel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fernandez. Ms. Green, you're invited to the podium. And you are recognized whenever you're ready.
Thank you. I'd like to say ditto to everything that everyone else has said, because much like they have said, I have some very similar statistics for you and some numbers for the nursing homes across the state. My name's Tracy Green. I've been a licensed nursing home administrator for the last 21 years, and I currently serve as the Vice President of Operations for Southern Healthcare Management. We operate 29 nursing homes across the state and take care of approximately 3,000 residents. I am also the chair of Florida Healthcare Association's Emergency Preparedness Committee. Florida Healthcare serves over 600 nursing homes and assisted living communities, and I oversee our emergency management activities on behalf of them. Prior to COVID, my company employed approximately 4,500 employees to care for our residents. When COVID first hit, we lost several hundred employees due to childcare issues, fear of COVID and bringing it home to families. And we also lost many employees to staffing agencies, much like you have as well. And those numbers continue to decline today. Our employees can go to higher paying jobs in other industries, such as fast food, Target, Amazon, they're all raising their rates, and we are in competition now with CNAs for them. Our personal care attendant program has been highly beneficial. So for those of you who are part of passing that bill last year, thank you. It has helped us out in ways that we couldn't have imagined. I went through the PCA program myself and worked as a CNA in several of our facilities throughout the year last year. COVID cases have continued to decline in long-term care since vaccinations came out, which is great, but our workforce challenges have doubled and tripled in many instances. Today, our centers have 8% fewer residents in our beds, but we have 15% fewer staff to take care of those residents. Our company alone has hundreds of open positions, just like all the other providers across the state, and we are really struggling to hire and retain staff. We are using temporary agencies to fill shifts in all of our facilities, and in several centers, we're having to limit admissions. Majority of our facilities are 120 beds, and in many cases, we have to limit the number of patients that we can have in our centers due to lack of staff. All of this comes at a significant cost, adding to the financial challenges brought on by the pandemic. We're losing staff to industries where jobs are easier and the pay is higher. We have some buildings where one-third of the nurses and CNAs are from agency, costing us at least $300,000 a month to pay for these agency staff. In the fourth quarter of 2019, we spent $100,000 in agency. In a similar quarter this year, we spent $2 million. And we're not alone. The use of staffing agencies across the long-term care profession is up by 250% over the last year. For example, Florida's six state veterans nursing homes typically operate at 98% capacity. Today, they only have 67% of their beds occupied. There is a waiting list of veterans who need skilled nursing care. However, the VA cannot admit these veterans because they cannot recruit the staff needed to take care of them. Those veteran nursing homes typically have between 10 and 12 open positions on average, but today they have 256 vacancies. Like us, all but one of their homes are using staffing agencies for direct care workers to provide the care that they need. This results in an access issue for veterans who need and have earned veterans nursing home care. The staffing agencies have unfairly taken advantage of the general labor shortage in the market by enticing away our center staff with offers of higher pay and then selling the staff back to us at a much higher cost, sometimes as much as 100% over what the agency is paying the staff. We're doing everything we can. We have raised wages in all of our centers multiple times this year, Every time we raise our wages, the staffing agency, a week or two later, sends a new contract, I see you shaking your head, and they raise their rates by $10 an hour over what we've offered. It's a cycle that we just can't seem to get out of. We are incentivizing our own staff. We're paying up to $10,000 in sign-on bonuses. We're offering $250 to just pick up one extra shift. But we're still losing our staff to staffing agencies. The cycle is unsustainable, and there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. Typically, we'd be able to recoup some of these costs by taking on new admissions from the hospitals. But as I said, staffing shortages are forcing us to limit the number of admissions that we take. The inability to take on these patients, they are happening across all providers across the state. Florida Healthcare conducted a survey and found that 52% of nursing homes across the state have been forced to reduce the number of admissions they take. The consequence of letting this crisis go unsolved, it really are significant. It's going to create an access issue for hospitals looking to discharge patients to our care centers, as well as individuals in the community seeking long-term care. This causes hardships for vulnerable seniors and veterans who need assistance and further exacerbates provider financial challenges. Our direct care costs, which is primarily CNAs and nurses, are up by more than 20% compared to pre-COVID. Statewide, nursing centers' costs have increased by almost $42 per patient per day compared to pre-pandemic time. That's a $600 million increase to facilities statewide. Labor is the primary driver for this increase. Just last week, one Florida provider, which operates 17 nursing homes across the state, filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy as a result of the pandemic-related financial challenges. We're afraid they're only the first. The impact of this bankruptcy filing is yet to be seen, but the negative effects are inevitable. I became a nursing home administrator in the year 2000. I love this industry, but I'm really afraid of what the future holds, and I appreciate your time listening to us.
Thank you very much, Ms. Green. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have great news. Help has arrived. So what we're going to do is, because I know, and this members gives you a moment to keep writing those questions down. We have been told that if we allow 5 minutes, you can each have your own microphones, and I think that will facilitate the asking and the answering of questions. So I'm going to say, we're just going to take an informal 5 minute recess. Don't go very far, everybody, because as soon as we're up and running, we will get to questions. Thank you. Members of the committee, if you would please take your seats. And you've heard it before, but we're going to say it again. Technology is great when it works. Unfortunately, we gave ourselves 5 minutes and it's still not working, but come back next week and maybe we'll have microphones. So I apologize. You're all going to get some great exercise. If you want to stand, it's up to you if you want to be standing, ready to go. But I'm certain, knowing the members of this particular committee and the great information that each of you provided for us, I'm certain that at least most of our committee members have questions of us. So who would like to go first? Representative Soroy, you are recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. I have a question for the panel, but I'd be interested in Ms. Mayhew's opinion on this. You know, we've heard a lot during the presentations about the need for apprenticeship opportunities and on-the-job training, other incentive opportunities in order to keep this workforce. I'm curious of the panel's opinion or position regarding scope of practice, independent practice, greater flexibility in some of these areas where we have the workforce, but we currently don't allow, you know, flexibility in different layers of participation in the medical field.
Ms. Mayhew, and if I could for the panelists and members, let me ask you this. When you have a question, maybe you'll indicate who that question is for at the beginning of your question. That way they can stand up, start to get ready to move. That'd be great. All right. Ms. Mayhew, you're recognized. We need to push a button.
Got it.
Thank you.
So appreciate the question, and I think so much of what we've been talking about here, it is multifaceted. There are so many different aspects of this that we've got to focus on. Certainly the urgency that we see is in expanding the pipeline of new, in particular, nursing graduates, looking at the challenges with recruiting nurse faculty in order to support those programs, clinical training sites. When we talk about scope, in a hospital setting, from a hospital perspective, we're really looking at, are we maximizing the team? Are we allowing individuals to work at their highest potential within their scope? Hospitals have been examining that for years as they look at that team at the bedside, making sure that, you know, in particular, you often hear about patients over paperwork. Let's make sure that we're not creating such administrative burdens that we're detracting from their highest, best use to fulfill their role at the bedside and as part of that clinical team. You are going to continue to hear more and more about that as we leverage not only the scope and the potential, but as we continue to leverage technology, as you start to get out into the challenges in the community, telehealth obviously allowing us to bridge gaps, to address travel issues, and to maximize the efficiency of the access that is so critical. In the hospital setting, as I mentioned before, you know, I've had hospital CEOs say, look, this may be the catalyst for some disruption where we've got to re-examine and reevaluate. I don't know that anybody's able to quite pinpoint what that is because it is a challenging environment, even more so today. If you are admitted to a hospital, because we have so tightened up the criteria for admission, you are very ill. To be in a hospital, insurance companies, Medicare, have really come down hard on the overnight, the one-night observational stays. And so it's a demanding environment at the bedside, but we do need to constantly examine the complement of staff and maximizing their highest and best use.
Thank you. Would any other panelists like to answer that question or speak to it? Anybody? Okay. Thank you, Representative Saroy. We have a question from Representative Garrison.
Thank you, Chair. I guess this question would be directed to Mr. Bennett or whoever would like to answer it. I guess as I listen to this, I keep thinking if I'm a young nurse or someone who with the ability to travel, what incentive is there for me not to be a traveling nurse?
Who'd like to ask that question? Mr. Bennett, you're recognized.
Thank you. Well, by definition, it's a temporary gig in this current market, right? So these are the wages that they're being provided are not going to last forever. It's in response to the pandemic. From a personal perspective, or from an individual's perspective, I mean, it makes sense. We understand why people are going after these gigs. In the face of burnout, higher compensation sounds really good. So do we have a strategy or a set of solutions around how do we compete against wages that are three times higher than what they're getting normally? I mean, the answer is no. That's part of the challenge that we're facing right now. One of the strategies we are trying to focus on in our career pathway programming is helping people understand how they build a career over the long term, not just a collection of jobs. The traveling nurse, the temporary contracted work is temporary, as we're seeing it right now, based on the demand that's out there right now. So we're hoping that at least we can tell that story that you may do this for 6 months, but then what happens after that? You know, where do you come back? We are seeing some of the health centers are bringing back people that they've lost for 6 or 12 months because they're done with that or that they were no longer needed and they're coming back to their regular jobs that they had before.
Thank you. Anybody else like to answer that? Mr. Fernandez, anybody want to take a... He answered it well. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Tant. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have several. So in terms of, Mr. Bender, you were talking about, and I wrote a note, you said that there's a federal program with no matching for loan repayment. Is that nursing student loans, or is that a different kind of loan?
So this would
be recognized, Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be at the provider level. It's focused on primary care. So, you know, traditionally our doctors, APRN, stuff like that, positions like that. As we understand it, it just came out today. It's up to $1 million that the federal government is going to offer. There's no match required. There's money in there for the state to administer it. And we see this as a really significant tool to develop a pipeline with these occupations.
Follow it.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Are there, and this is for anybody on the panel, are there nursing student loan programs that would help if we could keep them, if they were to be repaid, if they stay in place? So there is one.
You're recognized.
Aurelio Fernandez. I think we can develop. What I'm finding out is that the universities are willing to partner with healthcare providers, forgiveness of debt, of loans. If you work for 3 years after graduation, we will forgive the loans. I know we do an awful lot of loan forgiveness. We do a lot of scholarships. But I do believe that the state and the federal have a role in at least providing the money up front so these candidates can get an education.
One more question right now.
Thank
we'll
you.
Back if you still have more.
So is that, thank you, Madam Chair, is that just in your community or is that statewide?
You're recognized.
I don't know if it's statewide. I know in South Florida we do it.
Thank you. Next we have Representative Masullo. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Ms. Mayhew, if you wouldn't mind, or whoever else wants to answer it. Commander Perry said during the War of 1812, we have seen the enemy, and the enemy is us. In the last generation, we've made a lot of changes to the delivery of health care, some of which that we were hoping would make care more efficient and effective. Unfortunately, some of those changes have not. They've complicated care, and they've increased cost, particularly with our digitalization. Oftentimes, we'll see providers spend hours charting on patients where they used to be delivering actual care. That's increased the need for staffing in all areas throughout healthcare. One problem that I see happening that you all did not address is quality of care. When you're mixing these traveling providers with the providers on the facility staff, who they know are making one time, two times, maybe three times more than they are, it creates animosity. And you're starting to have enemy in the culture, where the culture of healthcare and the quality starts to deteriorate. And we've seen that in some organizations now. I think that's something that we need to address, but we should also look to address, and my question is to you, how can we change the way we're delivering healthcare to make it a little more efficient and effective with these new people that we will be providing slots for education for going forward?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So on both fronts, and you have highlighted two very important aspects of the workplace environment. And as I mentioned before, the focus by hospitals to reduce that paperwork burden, anything that is detracting from the care at the bedside that detracts from that fulfillment. Because at the end of the day, one of the things that we've been blessed by in healthcare is that generally there's significant interest among middle school students, high school students to pursue healthcare careers, for many to become nurses. And we want that to remain a fulfilling and rewarding career. And so we have to constantly re-examine how care is delivered, how it is managed, how it is overseen, to be efficient and to ensure that it is patient-centered. Now, the hospitals absolutely have a role in constantly evaluating that care at the bedside to ensure that it is efficient and effective and high quality. We have to constantly evaluate how regulations are complied with to make sure that we can minimize the administrative burden, again, so that it's a patient-centric approach and that the individuals are able to fulfill their role at the bedside supporting patients. That is part of the constant team evaluation and environment that helps to improve morale and commitment and retention in the workplace. You talked about as well the new nursing graduates, and you heard a lot about the mentorship programs, the apprenticeship programs. Those are also a critical component. You're being placed in a very intense environment. Having the mentors that are effectively trained to support you, we know has proven to increase retention rates. You also talked about the concerns about temporary staffing, and that is absolutely a concern because of the team environment that every hospital, every organization is trying to foster. And if you have individuals who are continually churning in and out of the organization, it detracts from that cohesive, team-based approach. So while we typically have some level of engagement with staffing agencies, what Mr. Fernandez outlined, what others have shared, it is at an unprecedented level in terms of that dependency, and it does detract from the kind of cohesive, team-based environment that leads to producing the highest quality of healthcare that we're all committed to. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Koster, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. My question's for Mr. Fernandez. We heard, I think, from Mr. Bennett that it's not that we're lacking interest in nursing applications. We're lacking maybe professors or other instructors. And you've spoken a lot about partnering with the healthcare system, with the universities, which I think is great. But I'm curious, how do those partnerships solve the short-term workforce crisis? Because obviously those nursing programs last a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then they only spin out baby nurses, right? We call them baby lawyers, baby nurses, right? So how does that partnership solve the short-term crisis?
There is no solution in the shortness. This is a 2 to 3 year journey. I just don't see it. Because there's a lot of retired nurses that could become faculty. So can we expedite the licensure process, meeting certain qualifications or experience criteria? That would add to the pipeline. But as far as an immediate solution, no. You know, the representative says, why would I not take a plane and be a traveling nurse making three times my salary if I'm in my 20s? And by the way, it's not happening just in your 20s. You have 30, 40-year-old seasoned professionals that are leaving the area. And the other thing that's happening is that within our market, if somebody in Dade County signs up with an agency that is working in Broward County, they don't have to get on a plane. And they're still making three times what they were making. And the salary escalation that Ms. Green was talking about, it just escalates. Because then everybody starts paying, and it becomes an unending issue. So, no, there is no short term. I believe that if we stay healthy and we don't have another surge, this Delta variant was completely devastating. It was worse than the one we had last summer. Another one of these surges, the staff will say enough is enough.
Thank you. Representative Brown. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
yes.
Okay.
You lean in a little bit more.
Both of my questions actually were kind of touched on, but if we can just get a little more elaboration. And one of those, Mr. Fernandez, was going to ask you or Ms. Mayhew, has there been a study, I know you've mentioned, about the crisis, but in particular with our professors? And just a shortage of those. Has there been studies looking at the reasons why there are shortages and how we can, fix that shortage? I know we've looked at, the nursing profession, but have we done one from a perspective of our faculty?
You recognize?
Well, We certainly have been having conversations with the Department of Education, with the Board of Governors, with community colleges to together start this process of understanding what is the demand for new nurses in the next 12, 24, 36 months, and what is the current capacity in the system. And typically that does come back to both the need for faculty as well as the clinical training sites. And you've heard a lot. There are hospitals around the state. We believe in the public-private partnership, and they are working collaboratively with their local nursing programs to look at nurse executives that can be supportive of and loaned to those nursing programs. we do need to examine and drill down on a specific number. So I have surveyed the hospitals to try to get at how many new nurses do you typically hire in 12 months, 24 months? How many do you now believe of new nursing graduates? Sorry, not new nurses, but new nursing graduates. How many do you think you now will need to hire in the next 12 to 24 months to try to get at what is the delta between the number that currently graduate, are expected to graduate, and what the true demand is for new nursing graduates? And to your point, to try to identify what that gap is and how many new faculty or additional faculty are needed to support that demand.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up? You're recognized.
And another question, just to look at the faculty shortage, is there an issue of their retiring out? Is it an issue where they are leaving the profession? We have not done enough to kind of recruit former nurses to go into the faculty perspective. Do we have any information on that?
You're recognized.
I'm sure there are many here that have far more information about it, but much like hospitals are struggling to compete with the staffing agencies, the universities, the community colleges are struggling to compete with the wages that a nurse can earn in so many other settings. The educational requirements are certainly part of the equation. The ratios that are needed to support the nursing programs as those are currently structured. So there are a variety of factors that contribute to the shortage and the need for additional faculty.
Thank you. Vice Chair Grant, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. This is directed to Ms. Green, if you would, please. I'm curious, you said that there was a difficulty accepting patients being discharged from hospitals. If you are not accepting them, where are those patients going, if you know?
You recognize.
That's a great question. A lot of them go home. If they don't gain admission into nursing homes, they go home with home health. Some go to assisted living facilities. Majority of assisted living facilities are private pay, so they would have to have the funds to be able to go there. But I would say the majority go home.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Altman, you're recognized for a question.
Yes, I think this problem is even bigger than COVID. I don't think there's a surprise here. I think anyone who's spent a lot of time in nursing home and hospitals, for example, realize that the vast majority of healthcare is provided by nurses and the remarkable service they provide. And they are underpaid. They were underpaid before. I think another sign that there was something not right was incredible low ratio of male nurses. I think it's like 9 to 1. Why are we not, we're almost cutting in half our talent pool. Why aren't males choosing this profession? And thirdly, the baby boomers. I mean, we knew, I've seen the reports, we're aging out as society, so the need for healthcare providers are going to be strained. My question is, why have nurses been so underpaid? Is it the insurance companies? Is it the management in our healthcare system? What is this choke point there? Why haven't we paid our nurses more, even before the pandemic?
Who would like to answer that question or attempt to? I mean, you can do it. Mr. Fernandez, you're recognized. Thank you.
It's a difficult question because they are well paid in considering the comparison in other industries. It's a very stressful job. They're underappreciated. It takes a long time to become a nurse. And think about it, you're entrusting your life in their hands because they cannot make an error. I think it's supply and demand, to be quite honest with you. COVID just elevated the level of awareness that we never had anticipated. We adjusted our nursing salaries $2 an hour in July. We adjusted the nursing salaries $1 an hour back in November of last year. We increased, and I know it doesn't have to do with nursing, we increased our minimum wage to $15 an hour because we were competing with the McDonald's and the hotels in the world. So salary, the pressure on increases salaries is significant, not just in nursing, but in all health caregivers. If you compare salary ranges, the nursing personnel is well paid, not compared to a physician. It's a different responsibility, different educational requirements. But historically, we look at nursing and do a salary evaluation and how they compare to the market. And we usually do salary adjustments. And I'm speaking for the industry. It's not only us, but the rest of the industry.
Thank you. Good?
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative.
Well, I have a,
oh, I'm sorry, a follow-up? I'm sorry.
You well, yeah, my point, though, I think they were underpaid even before the pandemic. I look at RN salaries, $64,000, $74,000 a year. I know restaurant owners are paying their bartenders $70,000 a year.
Representative Altman, I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, my question is, why are they underpaid? Why have they been underpaid even before the pandemic? What's causing that? Why can't we pay our nurses what they earn? I didn't hear an answer to that.
So perhaps the question is, how are nursing salaries determined originally?
Yeah, why are they so low? I guess that's my question. Why didn't the system make them so low? You mentioned that compared to other professions, but I don't think so. Given what they do, they're grossly underpaid. And now we have this pandemic that's only exasperated that. I'm happy that they're able to finally get what they deserve to make. It's unfortunate that those who stay in
hospitals. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Representative Altman, but I really need it. We need a question, sir.
And my question is, why are they so underpaid?
Okay, thank you.
It's a market-driven amount, and we feel that we pay our nurses adequately. As a matter of fact, we think we pay them very well. It goes by percentages. You're 50% in the 50th percentile or the 60th percentile, and that's how you gauge all the salaries, not just nursing, respiratory therapists, radiology therapists. So I think it's a market condition that drives the dollars.
Thank you. Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mayhew, I think this question is for you. And it's sort of a combination of Rep. Koster, Rep. Brown, and Rep. Altman's previous questions. This is not news, right? We knew there was going to be a nursing shortage years ago, probably decades ago. We had been talking about it in these very corridors. So we didn't do some of the things that we probably should have done, during the past. So if we increase faculty today, do we have a threshold of where we need to be to undercut the prediction that you have for the 60,000 nurse shortage in 2035. So if we had used sort of that lens 20 years ago and we had done what we needed to not be in the situation we are today, what do we need to do? Obviously, it's the long-term response, not the short-term responses, as you said. But what is, and I know Rep. Brown kind of got this question out too, but we really need to know specifically what we need to do.
You're recognized.
Thank you. And I would like to emphasize that there have been cyclical workforce shortages, healthcare workforce shortages, nursing workforce shortages over the last 20, 30 years that hospitals have, in fact, responded to with many of the same strategies in terms of the partnerships, paying for slots in community colleges, the scholarship programs, loaning nurse executives to support the faculty needs. But over that same period of time, healthcare has dramatically changed. As outpatient services have expanded, as there's been a migration from inpatient setting to the outpatient setting, nurses have, and I'm focused on nurses, but obviously there's so many more professions here that are affected, but nurses have so many more opportunities outside of the 24/7 environment of a hospital. So that has added to the competition. The aging of the population and the demand for services, again, both in the hospital setting and outside. One of the things that you did do last year was to restore funding to the Florida Center on Nursing, because it does need to be a data-driven analysis. There's probably one other piece that you could take into consideration, which is surveying nurses, getting real-time data and information about the decisions that nurses are making, whether they're staying within a 24/7 hospital environment, nursing home, or they're in other areas of healthcare, or they may be retiring early, to be gathering that. We tried to do some focus groups this past spring to gather some of that information. You also passed legislation to look more comprehensively across a number of economic sectors, workforce sectors, but you focused in on healthcare. That will continue to help and to inform. And you're right, we've got to be looking out and predicting and forecasting with a level of sophistication that we can look at the population growth, we can look at what is happening in healthcare. You know, there's a huge focus today on, somewhat driven by the pandemic, hospital from home. You know, as our technology increases and we can do more remote monitoring or support individuals at home, that's going to change some of the pressure, some of the demand. All of those need to be factored in that forecasting so that we can be more deliberate in the decision-making.
Thank you. Representative Skidmore, you have a follow-up? You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the Center for Nursing have the capability to do that type of predictive modeling?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I don't want to speak, but I did have a call with the center to talk through the analysis that we did with the Safety Net Alliance, the study that we commissioned to walk through that methodology, that analysis, to work collaboratively with the center so that they can draw upon some of the work that we've done along with the way in which they have analyzed this data in the past. So we are on the right path with the restoration of funding for that center and the work that they have in front of them.
And Mr. Bennett, excuse me, Ms. Mayhew, I believe, Mr. Bennett, you'd like to answer the question as well or speak to the issue. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So not to be a broken record, but I think there's two components to look at the nursing shortage, right? Number one, looking at supply. Number two, looking at capacity. From a capacity perspective, there are models nationally around apprenticeships, broken record, for nursing up to an RN. The reason why apprenticeships work so well is because all the evidence says that if you go through an apprenticeship, you are staying in that job. The retention rates for apprentices outmatch anybody, right? So that increases capacity for how do we actually train and then hire enough nurses. Apprenticeships increases capacity. How do you address supply? To me, that's an approach of career pathway 101, where we begin to look at, and I will say also, you know, our health centers would be upset if we focused only on nurses. Nurses are the backbone, but nurses can do what they do because of positions like medical assistants. The support, provider support positions that we have to be addressing as well. So if you build career pathways that give an easier entry point to healthcare through something like a medical assistant that then transitions into an LPN, that then to an RN, you're beginning to address supply. Part of the challenge that I think we're going to see over the next 5 years is a bit of a PR challenge about building a career in healthcare. It's a little bit like 20 years ago in manufacturing when we looked at manufacturing jobs as dirty jobs. Well, if you went to a manufacturing plant, you would see it was very clean, right? It wasn't accurate. What I'm worried about, what we're worried about, is who's going to want to build a career in healthcare after the pandemic, right? After what we've seen healthcare professionals go through. So addressing some of that PR component through career pathways that create easy entry points to healthcare careers, especially for those that aren't thinking about it in the first place, I think is going to do us a lot of good in addressing the supply component of that equation.
Thank you. Members, I'm going to take a brief, a little break in questions. We still would have some more time, but we do have one individual who's filled out an appearance card. So if our panelists will just stay where you are for a moment, I'd like to recognize Tyler Sununu with the Florida Association of Rehabilitation Facilities. Thank you for being waiting so patiently. You're recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you for holding this very important meeting today. And thank you, Mr. Fernandez, for recognizing that this is an issue to all healthcare providers and healthcare professionals. I couldn't miss this opportunity to share some of our providers' challenges. Florida Association of Rehabilitation Facilities represents close to 60 providers who provide the full spectrum of services to support the various needs of individuals with disabilities. And this is to thousands of individuals across the state. We're having the same labor difficulties that were shared here today. Our member agencies have reported 23% of their positions being unfilled, which has resulted in 75% of them having to reduce or discontinue services. And this has led to over 100 group homes closing in the state just this year. So our members have one payer, it's Medicaid, which has made this wage war impossible and untenable for our members to compete for nurses or, as we call them, direct support professionals who provide the day-to-day care that's needed for individuals with disabilities. So thank you for this. I'm here for any questions, any way I can help.
Thank you very much. Members, we still have a couple of minutes, I think, for questions. Excuse me? 8 minutes, I'm being told by Cheryl, so don't let a good panel go to waste. I'm sure we have more questions. Representative Brown, did you have another question? You're recognized.
Thank you so much. So we talked about the crisis. We hear it all the time about this crisis. But I wanted to kind of get to, and it was touched on a little bit, but look at how it has affected quality of care, where, you know, pre-pandemic versus now, how has it affected? And
who would like to answer that question?
Answer that question, whether it's the nursing homes or...
Mr. Fernandez, thank you. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, and I'll take that because it's very dear to my heart. There's a company called LeapFrog that provides grades to providers, hospitals, A, B, C, D, or F. And there's two cycles a year. And we were all A hospitals in LeapFrog. And this last cycle, we have one of our hospitals that was one of only 37 in the United States that had been a straight A hospital. And in this last cycle, they got a C. And it was all related to the infection or bets, whatever that COVID caused. So, yes, it is impacting quality of care. There's no question. And this is a way that you measure outcomes independent, and everybody has to respond in the same manner. So we're comparing apples to apples. So, yes, it does impact healthcare.
Thank you. Representative Davis, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure who this will be directed to, but we talked a lot about salaries, incentives. And I guess the first question of two would be, can someone tell me the average salary? I heard Representative Altman just talking about they're underpaid, but does someone have an indication of the average salary of an RN, an LPN, or a CNA in Florida?
Can anybody? Mr. Bennett, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we are in the middle. I don't have a solid answer today. We're in the middle of a salary survey addressing these very questions, including those positions. If you think about it from scope, if you think about it from sort of level in the organization, it's the first half from entry level to mid level that we are focused on right now. And what I would say is, we have to clean the data, so I don't have a good answer for you. What we are seeing time and time again is that the health centers are addressing wages with either temporary or permanent wage adjustments to try and mitigate both competition, but also to recognize level of effort, and that the geography, right, is going to impact wages. The size of the organization is going to impact wages. So we're working right now on that data to get our hands around that better ourselves as a means of helping the centers become more competitive. I will also say at what is relevant right now is adjusting to Amendment 2 from last year. We have some health centers that have already increased their minimum wage to the 2026 level of $15 an hour, but they're having to adjust some positions already for those increases so that come 2026 they don't have to feel it all at that point on the balance sheet. So there's lots of components at play around wages Amendment 2 the wage war, stuff like that, that we're actively digging into.
Additional question? You're recognized.
Okay, this is the one I've been waiting to ask. With the barriers that we're talking about today, when we're talking about recruiting and retaining, and we have the barriers in our healthcare system for our uninsured, and we're here in this situation, can anyone answer, do you think that the idea of expanding Medicaid could help this issue with increasing revenue in the state of Florida to help you with the retaining, recruiting of the nurse shortage or your healthcare professionals altogether?
With Ms. Mayhew, you recognize?
It's an excellent question. And I think what's important in any scenario where you are expanding access, often when we look at Medicaid expansion, we look at the charity care costs incurred by hospitals or other providers. The reality is when you expand coverage, as we would expect, individuals are going to use the system more appropriately and at greater levels. When you have that coverage, we want you at the right time, in the right setting, getting access to critical services. So typically you're going to see the volume of services provided increase. So I absolutely hear you in terms of the reimbursement as it relates to charity care, but you have to take into consideration the increased use of services and the demand that that places on the system and on the workforce to respond. That's a separate set of circumstances from how do you ensure people get access to care at the right time, in the right setting, so that they're not relying on, in fact, the most expensive entry point to the system, the emergency department.
Thank you. I think we have 1 minute, 2 minutes. Representative Koster, I think you're going to be all right. Representative Rizzo is on our list. If everybody's okay, he has not asked a question yet. So, Representative Rizzo, you are recognized.
Thank you. I'll try to be
you have 30 seconds.
Least verbose as possible. For any of the panelists, are vaccination mandates affecting what's going on? And if so, is there a way that you can quantify how it is doing that?
You're recognized.
Vaccine mandates, we were wondering if that was going to come up. I represent the nursing homes, and you know, initially the mandate came out that just applied to nursing homes, which terrified us. I will say for my company, we fully support vaccinating our employees as well as our residents. We are proud to say that about 80% of our staff are fully vaccinated and probably more than 90% of our residents. So we are encouraging it. We have gone fully mandated in some of our centers. We have lost staff because of it, and we do expect to lose staff, although it will be greatly beneficial for us that it will apply across all branches of healthcare and not just nursing homes. So we're very thankful for that. But yes, I do expect that to cause workforce shortages in addition to what we're already facing.
Okay, panelists, thank you very much for this, your presentations and your honest answers and this and taking part in this conversation with our committee today. And committee members, thank you for the robust conversation. I know I can always count on you to ask great questions that brings out information that not just you're interested in, but that the entire committee is interested in. So having said that, we are going to close our meeting. We'll see you back. In November, I think, is when we'll be back here, Cheryl. So this concludes our meeting agenda. Representative Davis moves, we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.